Recording. So welcome to class 10. This is on Fanny Burney, and we're going to be looking at Evelina, her most important and best loved work. So this obviously is leading us up to background of Jane Austen. It's leading us up to looking at Pride and Prejudice. So you need to be starting to read Pride and Prejudice. Has it ever begun, or have you read it before? You've got the translation.
I have read it.
Okay. That's fine. Get it. Yes. Yes.
You.
Oh, excellent! Excellent. That's it. That's it. Okay. Great. Well done. So let's have a look at this work, which comes from before. I'm going to hide the chat box. I'll open it up if I ask any questions. Otherwise, let's get going. So let's have a look. Now, Fanny Burney, 1752 to 1840. So born in the middle of the 18th century. Fanny is short for Frances. So Frances Burney, but we can call her Burney. So, Dr. Johnson certainly did. Sorry?
She died.
Oh, absolutely. She lived a long time. Very old. Yes, absolutely. No, it's very interesting. And even more interesting when you see what happened to her. Frances Burney was born in Lyme Regis in England. Lyme Regis is a lovely thing. Lyme Regis actually comes up in the Jane Austen novels. Not in the one we're going to read, but another one. It was a little Regency town. The Regency period is, you know, very elegant, lovely house, Georgian architecture. So, you know, she's part of this South of England ethos. She was born in Lyme Regis, and she was the daughter of Dr. Charles Burney, who was a musician and a music historian. And Frances Burney's mother, Esther, who's described by historians as a woman of warmth and intelligence, according to Wikipedia, was the daughter of a French refugee named Dubois, and she died, sadly, when Fanny was 10. Fanny was self-educated, and it's said that she started writing stories at the age of 10. You can imagine that, you know, perhaps she would have channeled some of her anguish and grief about her mother's death into this, you know, this writing project. Later on, when she was 41, she married a French émigré, General Alexandre Darblay, and during her life, you know, she travelled a lot, travelled to France. At some point, she was stranded there by the Napoleonic Wars, and she actually couldn't get home for about 10 years. And she later settled in Bath, another key Austen city in the south of England, and she died there. She was very prolific. She wrote 4 novels, 8 plays, 1 biography, and 25 volumes of letters and journals. And we got some of her journals in the Norton Anthology, and they're wonderful. I'm going to call your attention to some of them as we go through this next little section. Throughout her career as a writer, her wit and talent for satirical character were widely acknowledged, and for example, by literary figures such as Dr. Samuel Johnson. So Johnson knew Burney, and I recommend that you read the entry on page 2998 of the Norton Anthology, which starts Mrs. Thrale, so you can see how Johnson behaved when he was with her. Because he treated her as an equal. He said, "Burney, you must do this. Don't let them do that." Wonderful, wonderful description of the way that Samuel Johnson talked to her. Her early novels were read and enjoyed by Jane Austen, whose own title, Pride and Prejudice, derives from the final pages of one of Burney's works called Cecilia. Austen, we know, also subscribed to the publication of Burney's third novel, Camilla, which made Burney £1,000 from the subscription and another £1,000 from selling the copyright. And this allowed her and her husband to build a cottage near Dorking in Surrey. So she was able to actually make money out of her novels. I think before she discovered the subscription system, it was more difficult for her to make money out of it. But later on, she was pleased with that. And you know, we know that Jane Austen subscribed, because it's on there on a list of the people who contributed money to Camilla. Her journals are fabulous, and they record life at court, talking to the king, running away from the king, and then the king going, why did you run away? Because the king was mad. King George was mad. And in the court, people had to be very careful what they did. So she was very worried about the propriety. But I think most significantly for the modern world is her description of the mastectomy that she had to undergo in middle age. She describes an operation by doctors to take out breast cancer without anaesthetic, and it's horrific. But it's well, exactly, exactly, absolutely amazing, and you know, you feel for her. Page 203,005 is where the description of the mastectomy starts, and particularly page 3009. So it goes on for quite a few pages, but particularly, I mean, it's well, if you can bear, if it's not necessary, you maybe don't want to do it. But as a, I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of writing. Yes, no, don't if you don't want to. Okay, let's have a look at her her best loved work, Evelina. This was published anonymously in 1778 at the age of 26. I mean, as we saw before with Mary Shelley, who we'll remember comes later than Burney. But again, very young, brought up on a diet of books and writing from a very young age, and so at 26, she publishes this novel. And we can consider that Evelina is what's known as a Bildungsroman. This German word is sometimes used in English literary criticism. It means a coming of age novel. What does that mean? Coming of age. No? No, it means that the character inside the novel grows up, changes from being a child to become a bit more mature. There is a change in their understanding of the world. Okay, that's a Bildungsroman. And so we follow the development of the 17-year-old Evelina. I'll start to explain some of the storyline because it's actually quite complicated and it's long, it's quite a long novel. So you'll be grateful, I hope, that you don't have to read it because I've done it for you. This is a summary of it. Okay, so Evelina, she's been brought up in the country by an adoptive father who's called Arthur Villiers. He's a vicar, so a man of the church. After the rejection of by her aristocratic father and the death of her mother. Okay, so her aristocratic father doesn't know that she's there, or didn't want to know anything about her when she was a baby, or that's what she thinks, and her mother has died. When Evelina's taken to London by friends, she encounters social situations that put her character to the test, and eventually she finds love and she's reconciled to her father. It's an epistolary novel. Well, it's not an epistolary novel. I know you're going to use this. Yeah, I was asking you guys. What does it mean? Epistolary. What does that mean? Written by letters. In what way? Oh, okay. Well, yes, it's a collection of letters that compose the story. So the letters tell us from different points of view in some cases, and some of them are from Martha Villiers, most of them are from Evelina herself to her friends, or to Mr. Villiers. Okay, the novel examines the situation of young women, the manners of the age. It uses comedy, and it's set in the fashionable and not so fashionable parts of London and Bristol, near Bristol and Bath. And she exposes bad behaviour at various levels of society, particularly bad manners or selfish behaviour. And she does so with amazing vigour and frankness. And one of the main themes of her novel, of course, is a young woman going out into the world and immediately being the attention of lots of men. She's very, very pretty, and she becomes she has lots of unwanted attention from men, but she also meets the, you know, a nice young man, which falls in love with. The theme about marriage and getting married is very strong in the novel. You know, there are other characters who are also looking for husbands, men looking, possibly not looking for wives, looking for mistresses. You know, this idea of the marriage market. And this is one of the things which is going to be important for Pride and Prejudice, of course, because Pride and Prejudice opens with the lines, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." So, very famous quotation from Pride and Prejudice. So immediately goes to the heart of the matter. You know, if there's a young man and he's got lots of money, he needs a wife, doesn't he? We're going to give him one. We're giving one. Or find him a wife. So, let's have a look. So Evelina goes into society. Now, Evelina, at the beginning of the novel, isn't able to use her own aristocratic father's surname. So she has this funny little surname which has been given to her for no particular reason. Nobody else in the novel is called by this name. She's called Evelina Anvil. Now, this looks like quite a delicate, you know, sort of French-sounding ending, ville, for, you know, city or town. Anne, that's quite nice. But if you look at it, an anvil means one thing. Now, and this is one of the quite vigorous images that you see in this novel, that she's being hit on by all these men. Come and try and take her away, and they pull her here and there, and members of her family who try to impose their ideas on her. So she's, you know, she is receiving the blows of a hammer on top of her. It's a very interesting choice of name. Okay, so she's an orphan who's been brought up in the country at a place called Berry Hill. Now, you will remember, this is written in the 18th century, in a period when other writers who we have seen before have been very influential. You can remember any place that could be related with a name like Berry Hill. Who remembers in the Gothic novels? Open your chat box in the news if you want to write. Can you remember a name of a real place involved with the Gothic novels? Which was the home of a writer who Bernie would definitely have known about. No? Strawberry Hill. Strawberry Hill. What was Strawberry Hill? Now, you won't feel for some of those classes. It doesn't matter. Anna, can you remember? What or where was Strawberry Hill? It was the Gothic house built by Horace Walpole. The Castle of Otranto, well done. It was the image that was, so she's taken this, you know, Strawberry Hill, she's changed it into Berry Hill, so it's, you know, it's like a homage to one of her favourite writers. It's lovely. Okay. So she's been brought up in the country at Berry Hill by her grandfather's tutor, the Reverend Arthur Villiers, after the death of her mother, and then her grandmother remarried a Frenchman and went off to Paris. So she abandoned her granddaughter. To be brought up by Arthur Villiers. She's not been recognised by her aristocratic father, Lord Belmont. A friend of Mr. Villiers, Lady Howard, invites Evelina to her house. And then her daughter, Mrs. Mervyn, and her granddaughter, Maria, go to London to meet Mrs. Mervyn's husband. Now, he's a captain who's returning from 7 years at sea, fighting the French, I will remind you, the pre-Napoleonic wars. Evelina writes to her guardian and she asks for permission to go to London with this little group. So Mrs. Mervyn and Maria want to take her to London as a companion for Maria. So they go to London, they'll meet the captain as he comes home, and then they all come home to Lady Howard's house. And so she writes to her guardian and she says, "They tell me that London is now in full splendour. The two playhouses are open, the Opera House, Varney, and the Pantheon. You see, I have learned all their names. However, pray don't suppose that I make any point of going, for I shall hardly sigh to see them depart without me. though I shall probably never meet with such another opportunity, and indeed their domestic happiness will be so great, it is natural to wish to partake of it. She's trying to persuade him not to let her go. I believe I am bewitched. I made a resolution when I began that I would not be urgent. But my pen, or rather my thoughts, will not suffer me to keep it. For I acknowledge, I must acknowledge, I cannot help wishing for your permission. So she's very urgent. She says, oh, I don't want to be urgent, but please let me go. So she's very sweet. She writes a lot of these very submissive letters to this father figure of hers, who actually is as old as her grandfather, but she treats him like a father. And she says that he's very wise and he's very good, and he's very nice to her in the letters. And he said, of course you can go. But at the same time, she's very, very respectful to him. And this is one of the characters, one of the characteristics of her character, is that she is, you know, the embodiment of everything that is absolutely perfect, respectful to her elders, careful with her manners. What can we say? Okay, so they go to London, and Evelina goes to a ball. So Mrs. Mervyn and Maria and Evelina go to the theatre first, and they visit the parks, and they go shopping for new clothes, you know, Oxford Street, Regent Street, things like this. They have their hair dressed with powder, and at the ball, she offends a young fop who wants to dance with her. And then she meets somebody who's called Lord Orville. What is a fop? There's not enough information in that. It's a young man. Not quite. No. A fop is a very 18th century word for a young man who is rather affected in his manners. So he thinks he's rather beautiful. It doesn't mean he's gay. But if you can imagine something a little bit like a combination between this modern idea of, you know, perhaps metrosexual, you know, very interested in his own fashion. He thinks he's a prize for women. He thinks he's rather nice, but maybe he isn't. And so this is the idea of a fop. It's a pejorative word. Somebody who thinks he's better and more beautiful and more elegant than he really is. Okay? So let's have a look at this character, this fop. He's called fop. No, definitely not. No, very dated. It's archaic now. But used it a lot in the 18th century. And then it immediately went out of fashion after Jane Austen. So you know if you see a text with fop in it, it's from about this period. So you see it in Shakespeare as well, excuse me. So it comes from earlier. This young man is called Mr. Lovell. Mr. Lovell. She says, not long after, a young man who had for some time looked at us with a kind of negligent impertinence advanced on tiptoe towards me. He had a set smile on his face and his dress was so foppish that I really believed he even wished to be stared at. He wanted to be looked at. And yet, he was very ugly, poor man, bowing almost to the ground with a sort of swing, waving his hand with the greatest conceit. After a short and silly pause, he said, Madam, may I presume? And stopped, offering to take my hand. Look at the spelling of stopped, everybody. Look at this. When you think about pronunciation of words, you do see in the text here, pronunciation, which will show you exactly how they were saying these words. And as you can see, that's the modern pronunciation. Stopped. He offered to take her hand. I drew my hand back. I drew it back. It could scarce forbear laughing. She laughs at him. She can't stop herself. Allow me, madam, continued he, affectedly breaking off every half moment. The honour and happiness, if I'm not so unhappy as to address you too late to happiness and honour, wants her to dance. And she tells him that she's not going to dance with him because she's already told somebody else that she's going to dance with him. But it's a lie. And then he comes back later on and he's very angry with her. Anyway, he's very bad-mannered. But she meets Lord Orville. Lord Orville is the love interest. So we see him described here as very nice. Soon after, another gentleman, who seemed about 26 years old, gaily but not foppishly dressed, and indeed extremely handsome, with an air of mixed politeness and gallantry, desired to know if I was engaged or would honour him with my hand. So she goes off and she dances with him, of course. And there's going to be this off-on-off romance with him all the way through the novel, with him being very, very polite and her being very worried and not saying very much. Okay. As they have danced, she's danced with him, but they're still at the ball. And there are several dances, several tunes, people change partners and they go off and perhaps they drink something at a little table. And in this scene, we see something which we're going to see in Pride and Prejudice. At the ball, Evelina's friend Maria goes for a drink. And at the table where she's standing, she overhears Lord Orville talking to somebody else, talking to another man about her. Let's have a look at the scene. So presently after, a very gay-looking man, remember gay means happy, perhaps bright clothes, but generally gay means happy, okay? So a very gay-looking man stepped hastily up to him and cried, "Why, my lord, what have you done with your lovely partner?" "Nothing," replied Lord Orville with a smile and a shrug. "By Jove," cried the man, "she is the most beautiful creature I ever saw in my life." Lord Orville, as though he might, laughed, but answered, "Yes, a pretty, modest-looking girl." "Oh, my lord," cried the madman, "she is an angel." "A silent one," he said, because Evelina hasn't said anything or has said the minimum to Lord Orville when she dances, because she's very shy. "Why, aye, my lord, how stands she as to that? She looks all intelligence and expression." And Lord Orville says, "A poor, weak girl," he said, shaking his head. "By Jove, my dear, I'm glad to hear it." He's glad to hear it because he fancies his chances with Evelina. This character is called Willoughby. So Clement Willoughby, and he is very interested in Evelina and pursues her throughout the novel and causes her lots of problems. In fact, at one point, by pretending to be Lord Orville. Okay, now, how is this related to Pride and Prejudice? Well, this scene is imitated in Pride and Prejudice in a slightly different form. It's an overheard conversation, passing judgment on a girl at a ball. We're going to see it quite soon. It's quite early on in the novel, so look out for it, okay? I'm not going to take this as a set. I'm not going to do spoilers. I'm not going to tell you exactly what happens. Also, start looking out in Pride and Prejudice for characters like this Fop novel, who causes problems and thinks that he's wonderful. And this libertine character, Willoughby. Willoughby here. In fact, I'm not going to give you any more spoilers, but look out for a character who, in fact, also has a fairly similar name to Willoughby's. Aha! Right, okay. So you have to look out for some of those in Pride and Prejudice. Then we meet some new characters, Captain Mervyn and Madame Duval. Now, Captain Mervyn, of course, is Mrs. Mervyn's husband, who's been a sea captain at sea for 7 years. He's got a daughter who's 17, he hasn't seen her for 7 years, and he's come back after, you know, this tour of duty, probably with Nelson in the Navy, and he arrives in London. And he turns out to be the most incredibly vulgar, offensive, rude. He's horrible to his own family. The women in his family just seem to accept the way he is. But he's fairly horrible to everybody else. He criticizes his own daughter. He says her nose is too big. You know, you've grown up really horrible in the last 7 years. And it's a fascinating character. It's quite he's quite unusually horrible for any kind of character, even novels of this period. It's unusual. And after some visits to the theatre and the opera, so he starts, you know, joining in the activities in London, they meet Madame Duval. by chance when they're looking for a coat. Okay, now Madame Duval is Evelina's grandmother, the one who ran off to France, married a second time, and she has come back to Britain from Paris. Originally, she is an English woman. She used to be a barmaid before she married Evelina's grandfather. But now she's sort of become Frenchified. And she says phrases with little French expressions in them and makes little mistakes like double negatives, which, you know. So, let's have a look at how the captain and Madame Duval interact with each other. We went last night to see the Fantoccini, where we had infinite entertainment from the performance of a little comedy in French and Italian by puppets, so admirably managed that they both astonished and diverted us all, except the captain, who has a fixed and most prejudiced hatred of whatever is not English. Now, this is one of his characteristics, is that he hates people who are not English. He hates anything that's not English. So he hates French things, he hates French people, absolutely loathes Madame Duval. When it was over, while we waited for the coach, a tall, elderly woman brushed quickly past us, calling out, "My God, what do I do?" You know, she's lost, she can't find a coat, a carriage to take her away, to take her back to her house. Okay. And so they take her in their carriage, they give her a lift, and the captain starts arguing with her. He says, "Hold your tongue, for I must make bold to tell you, if you don't, that I shall make no ceremony of tripping you out of the window, and there you may lie in the mud till some of your monsieurs come to help you out of it." This is quite brutal. This is in the very first, 10 minutes of meeting this woman. Their increasing passion quite terrified us, and Mrs. Mervyn was beginning to remonstrate with the captain to tell him, "Oh, don't do that." When we were all silenced by what follows, "Let me go, villain that you are, let me go, or I'll promise you I'll get you put to prison for this usage. I'm no common person, I assure you, and ma foi, I'll go to justice fielding about you, for I'm a person of fashion, and I'll make you know it, or my name Aunt Duval." So we discover in this way that they have by accident bumped into Evelina's grandmother. And Evelina, of course, is very dutiful and immediately takes to her grandmother and, you know, this, oh, my grandmother, you know, this is lovely scene where she, you know, she's very happy to have found her again. But Madame Duval turns out to be a very strange character, and some things start happening to her. And we realise that Captain Mervyn is very keen to play tricks on people. After an evening out, Madame Duval is getting into a coach with her friend Monsieur Dubois when they both fall into the mud. And Captain Mervyn's delighted. In fact, later on we begin to suspect that it was actually the captain who might have pushed her. Monsieur Dubois was... sorry, hang on a minute. Monsieur Dubois was so obliging, though I'm sure it was an unlucky obligingness for me, as to lift me up in his arms to carry me over the place that was ankle deep in mud. They're outside an opera house, I think, and there's mud on the floor. They're dirty in London in those days. And Monsieur Dubois picks her up to carry her over the worst part. But instead of my being ever the better for it, just as we were in the worst part, I am sure I wish we had been 50 miles off, for somehow or other his foot slipped. At least, I suppose so, though I can't think how it happened, for I'm so great weight. But however that was, down we both came together, all in the mud. And the more we tried to get up, the more deeper we got covered with the nastiness. And my new Lyon negligee, too, quite spoiled, so her clothes are covered in mud. However, it's well we got up at all, or we might have laid there till now. For what you cared, nobody never came near us. So nobody helped her. They were there at the opera or the theatre together, and she had to get up and walk off in the sort of wallow covered with mud. And they're very angry. But how does the captain react? He says, she says, "This recital put the captain into an ecstasy. She went from the lady to the gentleman, and from the gentleman to the lady, to enjoy, alternately, the sight of their distress. He really shouted with pleasure, and shaking Monsieur de Bois strenuously by the hand, wished him joy of having touched English ground. And then he held a candle to Madame Duval, that he might have a more complete view of her disaster, declaring admittedly that he had never been better pleased in his life. Really, really happy. He just laughs. And you can see that he enjoys other people, particularly Madame Duval, suffering. Now, the libertine, Sir Clement Willoughby, who was so interested in Evelina at the ball, soon finds that the best way of ingratiating himself with Captain Mervyn, because of course Evelina is living in Captain Mervyn's house, so Clement Willoughby kind of tries to enter the circle where Evelina is. The best way to do this is to make Captain Mervyn happy by teasing Madame Duval. He does this so he can be near Evelina, who doesn't know anything about his plans and who's falling in love with Lord Orville. So it becomes more complicated. Now, the Mervyn family return to their country house. They take Evelina and they take Madame Duval as well, because Madame Duval, you know, out of politeness, because Madame Duval is Evelina's grandmother. So Clement Willoughby arrives, and Captain Mervyn and Willoughby plan a prank on Madame Duval. They trick her into thinking that Monsieur Dubois, the Frenchman, is in the Tower of London under arrest. And when she sets out to London to help him, they attack her and tie her up. Evelina knows it's a trick, and sees that Sir Clement, who tries to declare love to her in the middle of the episode, it's like, he gets her alone in the coach, in the carriage, but she manages to fight him off. And then she goes and she rescues her grandmother. It's an extraordinary scene. This is really quite violent. You won't see anything like this in Jane Austen. In Jane Austen, everything is much, much calmer, much less violent than this. But it's comedy, but it's very wild comedy. I saw that her feet were tied together with a strong rope. It was fastened to the upper branch of a tree, even with a hedge which ran along the ditch where she sat. I endeavoured to untie the knot, but soon found it was infinitely beyond my strength. I was therefore obliged to apply to the footman, but being unwilling to add to his mirth by the sight of Madame Duval's situation, even the footman was laughing because they are in on the joke. They know that it's just a prank. They're not real thieves. They haven't been robbed by real highwaymen. I desired him to lend a knife. I returned it and cut the rope. Her feet were disentangled. The servants were ready to die with laughter the moment they saw her. But not all my remonstrances could prevail upon her to get into the carriage, so she had most vehemently reproached them both for not rescuing her. The footman, fixing his eyes on the ground, as if fearful of again trusting himself to look at her as he laughs, protested that the robbers had vowed they would shoot him if he moved an inch. And one of them had stayed to watch the chariot while the other carried her off. So, it's that's really funny, actually. It's funny, but shocking at the same time. And of course, the interesting thing, of course, is that while we're getting these tremendous high comedy and people giggling and laughing at the comedy inside, and possibly the reader is torn between, do I laugh at this? It's funny, what's happening to her is funny, that's quite funny. But at the same time, Evelina's response is to say, okay, well, this is shocking. Poor Madame Duval. I can't tell her that there's this prank thing going on, that would be shocking. Okay, right. The Scottish Lodger. Madame Duval now insists that Evelina go and stay with her. So they go back to London. They're in a less fashionable part of town with Madame Duval's nephew's family, the Brangtons. So the Brangtons are in trade. They're not aristocratic. And they live in a shop, with a house above the shop, and there's an apartment or rooms that have been hired out to somebody else. So Evelina meets the lodger who lives in the apartment in the Brangtons building. So he's a young Scottish man, and she sees that he's depressed. One day she notices that he has a pistol in his pocket, and she follows him and she stops him from committing suicide. And Toronto has to give them some money. This is quite funny too. In a moment, strength and courage seemed lent to me as my inspiration started, and rushing precipitately into the room, just caught his arm, and then, overcome by my own fears, I fell down at his side, breathless and senseless, so he faints. My recovery, however, was, I believe, almost instantaneous, and then the sight of this unhappy man regarding me with a look of unutterable astonishment, mixed with concern, presently restored me to my recollection. I arose with difficulty. He did the same. The pistols, I soon saw, were both on the floor. So she picks up the pistols. I seize the pistols. He said not a word. He made no effort to stop me. I glided past him and tottered downstairs before, ere he had recovered from the extremest amazement. The moment I reached again the room I had so fearfully left, I threw away the pistols, flinging myself on the first chair, gave free vent to the feelings I had most painfully stifled in a violent burst of tears, which indeed provided a happy relief to me. The shock of having taken the pistols away from the poor man who was going to blow his brains out. But she saved him, and she writes a little letter to her guardian to say, I didn't know what to do, I've done the right thing. And he writes back saying, oh, that was absolutely the right thing, that was really good, that was excellent, you've saved somebody from committing suicide. Okay, then we meet Orville's snobbish sister. Evelina's cousins take advantage of Evelina's friendship with Lord Orville by borrowing his carriage. And this makes her very, very embarrassed. She sends him a note of apology. And the letter that she gets back again seems to be declaring that he loves her, but in a terrible, distasteful way. Oh, my darling, you are the only one for me, kind of thing. So she's a bit shocked. Oh, how can you say things like that? He seems so polite. She starts to avoid Orville, and the effect on her health is terrible because, of course, she's very stressed by having to try to avoid him when she knows that she really loves him. She thought that he was nice. She gets ill. So the family send her away with a friend who's called Mrs. Selwyn to visit another person who's called Mrs. Beaumont, and they go to Bristol. Mrs. Selwyn is wonderful. She is ironic and sarcastic, and she says the most wonderful things to people's faces in the novel that you think, oh my God, that's brilliant. You know, it's real proper British irony, sarcasm. Okay, so they go to Bristol. And there they find that Lord Orville is going to visit the area because his sister Louisa is engaged to be married to Lord Merton. Lord Merton, we know, has tried to seduce Evelina, as practically every person in the novel has done, except, of course, Lord Orville. Look out for brother and sister relationships in Pride and Prejudice. You will see an interesting and very, you know, nice version of this. This brother-sister relationship here, where the hero has a younger sister and is, you know, trying to be careful about who she marries, is funny because, of course, the sister doesn't appreciate it. The sister is very unpleasant, actually, and particularly nasty to Evelina. In fact, Prejudice is a lovely younger sister situation like this, where the sister actually does appreciate what's being done for her. And it's interesting to compare them. But let's have a look at Louisa. This is when we first meet Louisa. Meantime, the lady, who seemed very young, hobbling rather than walking into the room, she's been riding with Lord Merton, made a passing curtsy to Mrs. Beaumont, saying, how are you, ma'am? And then, without noticing anybody else, with an air of languor, she flung herself upon a sofa, protesting in a most affected voice and speaking so softly she could hardly be heard. She was fatigued to death. Really, ma'am, roads are so monstrous dusty, you can't imagine how troublesome the dust is to my mind. It's untoned, monstrous, disagreeable. I dare say I shall be so tanned I shan't be fit to be seen this age. So she's saying, oh, God, just the dust, the sun, oh, it's terrible. I'm going to die. So she's quite a snobbish character, and she doesn't speak. She hardly speaks to Evelina, even when it's evident that her brother is not with Evelina. So she thinks that Evelina is a nobody, because she's an orphan, she doesn't have a name, and she doesn't know about this aristocratic secret father. So she practically ignores her. Okay, in Bristol, Orville spends quite a lot of time with Evelina. The Scottish lodger reappears to try and pay back the money that Evelina has given him. And it turns out, in fact, that he's Evelina's brother, a secret brother that she didn't know about. At the house in Bristol, they're surrounded by libertines and snobs. What's a libertine? Yes, exactly. A libertine is a man who goes from one woman to another, has no morals, and is generally very unpleasant. Okay, there's a horribly hilarious episode where the three of the men who are staying in this house want to lay a bet. Now, Orville doesn't gamble. It's very interesting. The novel actually speaks out against gambling, which, you know, was probably a social problem at the time. If you remember back to Pope and the card game of, what was it called, Ombre. This was one of the big things that people did in those days, and it caused problems for people. They want to lay a bet, and they try to decide what to bet on. And they decide to make it about a race between two old ladies, over 80 years old, to see which one will win. Yes, are you shocked? You think, oh my God, that's ridiculous, they won't do it, but they do. And this is part of the scene where the old ladies run a race. So they found two, old ladies from the country, and so one of them is going to belong to one of the men. It's like betting on horses or betting on dogs or betting on anything that moves. For some time, the scene was truly ridiculous. The agitation of the parties concerned and the bets that were laid on the old woman were absurd beyond measure. Who are you for? And whose side are you on? Was echoed from mouth to mouth by the whole company. Lord Merton and Mr. Coverley were both so excessively gay and noisy that I soon found they had been free in drinking to their success. They handed with loud shouts the old woman to the race ground and encouraged them by liberal promises to exert themselves. And the signal was given for them to set off. The poor creatures, feeble and frightened, ran against each other. Neither of them able to support the shot, they both fell to the ground. And a debate ensued. So one of them falls down a little bit later on. A debate ensued, but the poor creature was too much hurt to move and declared her utter inability to make another attempt. Mr. Coverley was quite brutal. He swore at her with unmanly rage and seemed scarce able to refrain even from striking her. Lord Merton then, in great rapture, said it was a hollow thing, but Mr. Coverley contended that the fall was accidental and time should be allowed for the woman to recover. However, all the company being against him, so he was pronounced the loser. This is quite an astonishing occurrence in any kind of novel. When you think you're seeing polite society, and this is really the underside of the horrible cruelty and vulgarity of some types of aristocratic society. Okay, right. Evelina's reconciled with her father. Evelina discovers that her father was tricked into adopting another baby girl instead of her when she was child. So her father, all this time, has thought that his daughter was, with him, and this young lady. And because Evelina's been in the countryside and been, apart from society, she has never found out about this. And her father can see that she looks exactly like her mother, so he recognises her as his daughter. And she gets engaged to Lord Orville. And Lord Orville goes and presents her again to his sister. She now has the surname Belmont. She doesn't need to be called Miss Amber anymore. Now she's Miss Belmont. An elegant French name. Miss Belmont, said Lord Orville, can receive no luster from family, whatever she may give to it. So he's saying, she doesn't receive reflected glory from having an aristocratic family. She gives reflected glory to her family. She is the one who is, they are benefiting from having her in the family. Louise, then, you will, I'm sure, be happy to make yourself an interest in the friendship of Miss Belmont, whom I hope shortly, and of joining in the friendships, to have the happiness of presenting to you by yet another name, and by the most endearing of all titles. This lovely little, this is the way that Lord Orwell speaks, isn't it? He's delicate, he's thoughtful about Evelina's needs and wants, and protects her at all times, and very gently suggests that, you know, that she's going to change her name and become Lady Orwell. I believe it would be difficult to say whose cheeks were at that moment of the deepest dye. So it's difficult to say who was blushing most, Lady Louisa's or my own, for the conscious pride with which she had hitherto slighted me gave to her an embarrassment which equaled the confusion that an introduction so unexpected gave to me. She saluted me, however, and with a faint smile said, I shall esteem myself very happy to profit by the honour of Miss Belmont's acquaintance. So when pushed into it, Louisa finally admits, you know, okay, I will be polite to you finally. What does this word slighted mean? To slight. Anybody have any guess? Yes, it's something like that. If you slight somebody, either you offend them directly or you ignore them and give offence in that way. And slighting is something that, you know, this is a concept. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's this kind of thing, yes. So you're going to see this kind of thing happening by prejudice, people worrying about being slighted, people slighting other people. Goodness me. This was, you know, one of the big worries, of course, of this period. Okay. The captain has one last prank to play on the fop, Mr. Lovell. Now, do you remember Mr. Fop, Mr. Lovell from the beginning? Mr. Lovell was the fop at the ball. And, you know, he fancied himself. He was offended because she wouldn't dance with him. Exactly, yes. Can you remember what he looked like? She said something about the way he looked. What was his clothes? Was he handsome?
No,
he was. He was well dressed, but he was very ugly. He was ugly. The captain has thought up the most terrible prank to play on Mr. Lovell. By this time, you know, the story is coming to an end. And we have seen that Evelina is going to marry Lord Orwell. You know, you think everybody's happy. And because people are coming together, the family are coming together to celebrate the marriage, we see lots of characters come together in situations. And so the captain appears again. And he's in the same house as Mr. Lovell, who's on a social visit, and the captain abruptly says, hey, have you a brother in these here parts? Mixer? No, thank heavens, I'm free from all encumbrances of that sort. Well, cried the captain, I met a person now just now so like you, I could have sworn he had been your twin brother. And then to the utter astonishment of everybody but himself, he hauled into the room a monkey, fully dressed, and extravagantly a la mode. Poor Mr. Lovell, too much intimidated to stand it. They start arguing, why have you brought this monkey into the room? The captain, you know, sort of saying, oh, you know, he's just like you, you look the same. Poor, and he's trying to decide whether to fight a duel with the captain. But of course, Mr. Lovell is too much of a coward. He doesn't want to fight. So that they argue a bit, but poor Mr. Lovell, too much intimidated to stand his ground, yet too much enraged to submit, turned hastily round and, forgetful of consequences, vented his passion by giving a furious blow to the monkey. He hits the monkey. The creature, darting forwards, sprung instantly upon him and clinging around his neck, fastened his teeth to one of his ears. So the monkey bites him on the ear. And the rest of the scene is with Lovell with blood pouring down his face and onto his clothes. And he goes, oh, my clothes! What am I going to do? And then he decides that he's not going to fight a duel with the captain because he definitely thinks that the captain, of course, is a military man and it's going to win. So that's a very, very curious episode, very violent, very cruel. And in the end, Evelina marries Orville. This is the final little letter. So she writes to her grandfather, tutor, guardian figure. All is over, my dearest sir, and the fate of your Evelina is decided. This morning, with fearful joy and trembling gratitude, she united herself forever with the object of her dearest, her eternal affection. I have time for no more. The chaise now awaits, which is to conduct me to dear Berryhill and to the arms of the best of men. So she's going to go back, and they're going to visit him now they've got married. A chaise, does anybody know what a chaise is? No. It's a type of transport. Type of transport, so what could it be in those days? Yes. So it's a carriage of some sort, isn't it? Yes. It won't be one of those carrying chairs, although it looks kind of similar. Chair, chaise, no, it's a carriage. It's got wheels and horses in front of it. You'll see this kind of transport, of course, in Jane Austen. You're going to see carriages and chaises and coaches and things like this, particularly carriages. Although horses, actually, one of the characters gets ill because she doesn't travel by carriage or chaise. She goes by horse and she gets wet in the rain and falls ill. Okay, so that's Evelina. What do you think? Yes. It's comedy. Yeah. It's entertaining. What did you think of them? Let me think. Let me count. How many men were interested in Evelina is what it was this question. Yes, I'm sorry. I simply couldn't fit them in. It's enormous. It's enormous. Well, okay, right. So there's Lovell at the beginning, and Orville himself, of course. Then we've got Sir Clement Willoughby, who is very insistent and tries to take her hand all the time and propose to her in carriages and things like this. Takes her the long way around in a carriage and is promising to take her home from the opera and rescue her. He takes her the long way around and tries to hold her hand and says he loves her. Then they go to the pleasure gardens at Ranelagh, and this is a kind of dubious place to be if you're not protected by somebody in your party who's going to walk with you all the time. And Evelina gets separated from the party. I can't remember what the separation is caused by lighting, some loud sound or something like that, and they shriek and run away, and they get separated. She gets separated. She discovers that she's walking in these avenues of trees, and it's dark. There's some lighting, but she's walking around in an evening gown, and men come up to her, and they presume that she's a prostitute. And the only way that she can save herself from this situation is to latch on to two other women that she sees in the avenue and sort of put herself between them. Oh, ladies, will you protect me? Take me back to my group, see if I can find my friends. Will you help me? And they laugh a little bit, but they help her to get back to her group. And she finds out later on that they are prostitutes. So she's rescued by these prostitutes. Lord Orville sees her with these ladies, and he's shocked, of course. And then later on he says, did you really know those people? And then there are people who come into the house of cousins. So there are two girl cousins, and they have boyfriends or suitors, and the suitors of the cousins also hit on Evelina. They also said, oh, Evelina, you are very pretty. And, you know, these horrible scenes where every single man that she meets of her own age tries to get off. And also, Lord Merton, who we see with the race for the old ladies, Lord Merton meets him quite early on, before we realise that he's engaged to Lady Louisa. So he's in the same room as Lord Orville, so he behaves himself, but he kind of leers at her, and he looks her up and down, and he kind of goes, oh, you are a bit of a, oh, lovely, aren't you, my dear? And he's older than Lord Orville, and he's a very, very unpleasant, a very lecherous character. And then when she discovers in Bristol that he is engaged to Lady Louisa, who she hadn't met, Lord Merton pretends not to know Evelyn. He pretends never to have met her. He sees her and he goes, oh! And then when he's alone with her later on, and because they're in this house together, because he's there because of Lady Louisa, who thankfully he doesn't marry in the end. You think, thank God for that, they're both awful, but, you know, fancy being married to that. When they're alone, when Lord Merton is alone with Evelina at some point, he goes, oh, my dear, I didn't have a moment to know. He takes her by the hand, and he's just lecherous and really disgusting. So that's, how many is that? That's quite a lot, isn't it? I mean, yes, this idea, I'm very interested in the names as well. I mean, she's chosen, it's her first novel. She's chosen names from her knowledge of French, you know, Duval, Dubois, things like this, that Orville, or gold, ville, you know, respectability, but something French, rather elegant, or money, Orville. It's a funny name for us, but, you know, it does seem to have a significance. But anvil, the vill bit is the same as Orville, but anvil, Juncker, goodness me, and that's, whoa. she's very spirited, but she makes Evelina very, very innocent, very, she's conveying these transparent pictures of people behaving in these disgusting ways, and her shock and horror about it. So it's down to the reader to be shocked by what you're reading. And she leaves Evelina as a really respectable and concerned and confused, innocent. And she realizes slowly that she's got to protect herself from Willoughby, for example, and try and get away from him. But she doesn't make any judgments about these lecherous men. She simply lets us see that they are lecherous and that she's a victim of it, and that women at the time were not protected. They had, perhaps they did need protection, literally, by a man, and preferably a man who was respectable and would respect them in the way that Orville does. So it's very interesting. Description of society at the time for women. Okay, right, that is enough. The bell has gone. We must stop. Have a lovely Christmas, Aruni. Merry Christmas. And I'm going to have a lovely time.